Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hey there, hi there, ho there, you're as welcome as can be. Well, most of you are welcome. There are a few of you, you know who I'm talking about. This is the Commentary Track coming to you again as a sustaining feature. The regular host can't be here tonight due to illness, but I'm taking his place. My name is Frank Thompson, and I am glad that I'm here on this particular occasion because the guest for this episode of the podcast is the great Joe Dante. I've loved Joe Dante's movies since the very beginning. I saw his first feature, Hollywood Boulevard. Thought it was great fun. Saw Piranha. Thought it was even more fun. Loved The Howling. Loved his episodes of Police Squad. Gremlins, Explorers. He doesn't think much of Explorers the way it was released, but I enjoyed it. He did the greatest episode of the Twilight Zone movie. An episode of Amazing Stories. Or two episodes, maybe. I'm not always accountable for these things. The Burbs, one of my favorite movies, and we talk about this, one of the few movies that I can think of in which the sequel is better than the original, Gremlins 2, which is hilarious and has all sorts of great in-jokes, and it's just terrific. Very imaginative stuff. As you know, this is a podcast about movie history, and so Joe Dante is very much a part of movie-making present, even though he's had a good long career. But he's still going and still making new movies and doing new work. The reason I wanted him is that he really knows his movie history and he loves movies and can talk about them. So we spend a little bit of this time talking about his own career and a little bit just talking about other things, just movies in general and how we got interested. And I even force him against his will to listen to a couple of my stories, and I apologize for that, but hey, it's my podcast, come on. So, we had a great time in his office, and I really appreciate a busy guy like that letting me come in and pepper him with questions, but it was amazingly enjoyable, and I think this episode of the Commentary Track is amazingly enjoyable, and to prove it, you're about to enjoy it. Here's my talk with Joe Dante. I'll see you on the other side. I'm assuming you became a movie buff the same way I did, TV, right?
Pretty much. Although before we had a TV, I'm that old that I remember radio. Yeah. In the early 50s, we didn't have a TV, but I did go to the movies, and my aunts actually took me to, I think, either Pinocchio or Snow White or whichever Disney reissue was making its 7-year rounds at the time. And of course, that was quite impressive, and I was a huge Disney fan as a kid. I was hooked on the comic books, particularly the Carl Barks, Donald Duck, and Uncle Scrooge comics, and which even today are quite remarkable.
Oh, I agree.
But TV, yeah, was where I saw movies, but I wasn't interested in movies per se. I was interested in cartoons. And so, you know, our local theater had a Saturday matinee where they would run 10 cartoons and 2 features, and you could get in for a quarter. The first boy and girl in line got in free, so
wow. You
line up early. And I spent a lot of my time patrolling the aisles and looking for nickels so I could get more candy.
Yeah.
But the 10 cartoons were really the draw. And then when the movie would come on, it would have girls in it and women and stuff, and it would kind of be grown-ups and, you know, grown-up stuff. So I left. And then one day I stayed to see It Came From Outer Space, and I could see that I had been wrong, that sometimes these movies with adults in them could be okay. And so you have to remember, in the early 50s, most TV stations ran movies basically because there was nothing else to run.
Sure.
And the movies that they ran were largely Republic pictures that had been sold in a big load to early TV, and a lot of British pictures, and the occasional independent picture that didn't do well in theaters and that was rushed into television. So more often than not, you know, you would see pictures like Robot Monster. That had never played your neighborhood theater because they just weren't going to play those kind of pictures. And it was when you added that to, you know, the serialized stuff like Captain Video and his Video Rangers, and you know, the kid shows. Ernie Kovacs had an early kid show when I was a kid, and TV was a great medium for kids. And in fact, the 50s was a great time to be a kid. I think looking back, it may not have been quite as good a time to be an adult, but
possibly.
But
not.
At the time, there was a lot of kid-centric stuff going on.
Yeah, it was a decade meant for kids in many ways.
It was, and we took advantage of it. And I think the you know, later in the 80s, people looked back on the 50s the way that now people look back on the 80s today, because it was the time that they saw the formative things and the certain connections were made in their minds that they take with them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, it's funny how those things imprint so deeply. The cartoons that I remember watching as a small kid, and luckily I saw them, were the Betty Boops and the Fleischer Popeyes to a certain extent, but also the Warner Brothers stuff on TV.
Well, the Warner Brothers stuff didn't actually come in until the mid-50s, but the early 50s was largely Paul Terry tunes, many of them silence, and almost all accompanied by records where you could hear the needle drop. And the music, of course, had nothing to do with the cartoon. It was nothing would maybe... Occasionally, there'd be a little bit of miracle sync, but for the most part, nothing matched. And that was the easiest thing to show. Farmer Alfalfa, who was called Farmer Gray in New York, the New York market for some reason. And almost all these cartoons had different titles than the ones they were originally released to, because they had already been sold off to different home video companies or home movie companies and stuff, and they were all... You could never remember the title of a cartoon, let alone track it down. But then once the Warner stuff came in, they started to put on shows with hosts, where there would be a kiddie show host. And it was a guy named Sandy Becker in New York who was the host for the Warner Brothers cartoon stuff, the black and white cartoons from the 30s and 40s. And they made quite an impression. And then there was another guy named Officer Joe Bolton, who was the guy who was fronting the Three Stooges stuff. For kids, and it's that was my viewpoint at the time. I mean, I was a kid, and that I only saw things that were for kids. And I saw things for adults, I would get confused and not want to see them. But you know, looking back, it was a lot of the stuff is now on YouTube. There are a lot of kinescopes of some of these kind of shows, and they are remarkably primitive. But we really didn't care. I mean, it was entertainment in your living room. You know, and the whole appeal of television in the early 50s was that you could turn on the TV and you could see faraway places. You know, it was very much like in the early 30s, there were all these jungle documentaries that people made, because people go to Borneo and they would you know, show pictures of strange animals that you couldn't see anywhere outside a zoo. And people just weren't as sophisticated at the time. And the idea of Broadway in your living room was, you know, quite impressive, and it's why it sold a lot of TVs.
The kind of foreign experience that I treasured as a child and still do was the past. For some reason, I was always really interested in things before my lifetime. And so whenever I saw a movie, you know, there'd be a Helen 12 Trees movie just coming on television for no reason. And I just was fascinated by the cars and the clothes and the way they talked and everything. It was just amazing to me to think that I could look at people, and I had this sense that they were all dead, that I was seeing this other past world, and it was amazing to me.
Well, it is. We're really the only generation that's been able to look back. I mean, you can, in one day, you can watch an entire career of an actor. You can watch him when he started out when he was a kid, and you can watch him when he was old. I don't know that in any other time that kind of stuff has been available.
No, certainly there were revivals in theaters always, now and then.
Well, only of successful
pictures.
But
not much.
Only of very successful pictures. And often, you know, when they put out the Robin Hood again, the Ralph Lynn Robin Hood, it was in black and white because it was cheaper. In fact, Warner Brothers had a whole subsidiary called Dominant, where they would just re-release their old pictures, and Universal released them under different titles. And there wasn't a lot of respect given to old films, except for the fact they had movie stars in them who were still popular, and people wanted to see them when they were older. And every so often, a picture like King Kong would come out in 1952. There was this big reissue of King Kong, and it was a huge sensation because people had been off the radar for so long. And, of course, it was also very heavily cut, so people didn't realize until many, many years later, you know, exactly what the picture really was.
And things were not only cut for content, but they were just cut for length, because they would be releasing things on double bills.
There was some thought in the TV circles that nobody wanted to sit still for more than 90 minutes to watch a movie. So, you know, when King Kong played Million Dollar Movie in New York City, which was a program that ran 16 times in 1 week, it was cut to 75 minutes because that was how long the show ran, 90 minutes plus commercials. And so the picture started on Kong's Island. It was years later that I ever realized there was a prologue in New York.
Now, when you were watching these cartoons in theaters, they were just showing cartoons from earlier periods too, or
no?
I mean, not
theaters,
just
in theaters. They were running contemporary cartoons, but there was a hierarchy. When you went to the 10 cartoons, started out being mostly Disney's and Warner Brothers, which was great. Everybody loved those,
mm-hmm.
and they would applaud when those little cards came out with Donald Duck's face with the sunburst behind it, and all that, and that was cool. Then they started sneaking in some Woody Woodpeckers, which I guess they got a little cheaper. But Woody was kind of okay. He wasn't as good, but we liked him a little. But then they started a really sort of cut back, and we started to get Little Audrey, and we started to get Baby Huey, and Kermit and Catnip, and you know, the Paramount cartoons were just not as good.
No.
And then some of the Paul Terrys, the Heckle and Jekylls, were so cheaply animated that even kids, could see that this was not nearly as good as we've been watching Warner and Disney, and now we're looking at these scribbles. so it was kind of a, and then the Nadir came, of course, with Casper the Friendly Ghost, who every kid hated. Nobody ever, I don't know how that franchise managed to stay around, I don't know, because every kid I know despised Casper the Friendly Ghost.
I did too, yet I could still sing the theme song to you word for word, which I will not.
Don't do that.
But I can. I could also do Little Lulu. Which
well,
was also
that's Little Lulu, interestingly, which was a great comic book. The cartoons never played. They never played on TV, and they never played in theaters for whatever reason. There was like on the East Coast in New Jersey, there was a Little Lulu boycott or something.
Well, I saw them when I was a kid, because otherwise I wouldn't know the song. But they did definitely played
Little
on
Lulu,
TV. I Love Lulu just the same. Yeah, the same, yes. when did it happen in your life that you went from being just a regular kid who loved cartoons like all your friends did to wanting to know who made them and wanting to be a cartoonist yourself?
Well, I was drawing a lot, I was making up my own comic books, and I had characters that I had created that were sort of ripoffs of other people's characters. And my thought was that's what I wanted to do for a living, was I wanted to, you know, do comic books or maybe. I never even imagined working in animated cartoons because I didn't know how they were made, but comic books, yeah. And so I got into the storytelling aspect of doing comics, and that's what led me to sort of doing comics that riffed off movies that I had seen. So I started to get drawn into the movie idea, and of course, you know, in those days, you knew certain names. I mean, there were certain names who were famous, people who made movies. Walt Disney was famous, and Alfred Hitchcock was famous, and when he learned that he could merchandise himself, he became much more huge after the television show, and he created his persona and stuff. It was quite a remarkable piece of marketing, which I think he may have patterned after Cecil B. DeMille, who also was very successful at that. But aside from, you know, even directors as well known as John Ford were not household names, mm-hmm. you know, in the 50s when I was a kid. And so the idea of pictures being written by people and actually directed by people was, I think, a little above my pay grade when I was a kid. I did recognize actors, and I didn't know that they probably didn't make the stuff up. But that was about it. I never really gave much thought to how movies were made. I just enjoyed them.
Yeah. I think the same thing with me. Like you, I became familiar with Walt Disney's name before anybody else, because I was a kid born in the 50s, so I was coming up a little later, but the Mickey Mouse Club was on every day,
mm-hmm.
and then virtually every feature I saw.
Well, that was, again, another marketing piece of genius from Disney, because, he mortgaged everything to do Disneyland, which, as it turned out, was a great idea. But then also the idea of getting into television to promote the theme park that he was building was pretty much genius. I didn't have a TV at that point. But I was a huge Disney freak, and so when the Disneyland TV show came on, I happened to be, I had spent that year out of school with polio. And I had to be carried to a neighbor's house to watch Disneyland. This is what a freak I was for Disney. Then I got better, and then of course he realized the Mickey Mouse Club was a great way to merchandise all the other stuff, and plus use the stuff in the library and all that. I mean, it was really extremely clever.
Yeah, he was a brilliant guy. And then, of course, the Davy Crockett craze.
I had mine. I had my coonskin cap. I had my Alamo playset, which is very important.
Oh, me too. I now have one of each of the Alamo playsets.
Wow.
Because that's what started me on my path to the Alamo. And I, speaking of which, I have the geekiest question that anybody's ever asked you. Because I've written all these books on the Alamo more than anybody's ever should have written. I keep track of all Alamo references and everything. Now, of course, the Second Civil War.
Yes, indeed.
You blow up the Alamo, which is great. But the most obscure thing is, in the Amazing Stories episode you did with Haley Mills, throughout the episode almost, she carries around a bag with a big picture of the Alamo on it.
It's true.
And I kept thinking, there's got to be something deliberate about that.
it was just a little nod to my childhood. Because the Alamo was a big... You really can't go home again. You can't explain to people who weren't there at the time what a huge deal Davy Crockett and the Alamo was.
Yeah.
Even before the Disney movie version came out, he cobbled the TV shows together and made a movie. There was another Alamo picture called The Last Command with Sterling Hayden that the public made, which was I guess John Wayne had wanted to make it, and they didn't want to make it, and so he didn't get to make his until years later, and he was always kind of pissed about it. But in the Last Command, Davy Crockett is played by Arthur Honeycutt, who probably looks more like the real Davy Crockett than anybody else. Certainly didn't look like Fessbart.
Certainly a great portrayal, anyway.
But when he came on the screen, there was an audible gasp from the kids, because this is not Davy Crockett. How can they tell?
Nothing like him.
A big nose and a beard. This is not Davy Crockett. Where's Davy Crockett? Certain things get ingrained,
It was a huge deal. I realized some time ago that most everybody who has done important work on the Alamo and written real books with real historical books on the Alamo all came out of Fess Parker. I mean, they all did. It was like that explosion just kept rippling out into the universe.
It was amazing. I mean, I remember someplace was selling Davy Crockett bibs with pictures of Davy in action on the mattress. It said.
I'd like to see one of those. I actually have a friend who has spent most of his adult life collecting Davy Crockett things and has an entire room in which every single thing in it is Davy Crockett related.
Wow.
Curtains, rugs,
you name it, they made it.
Yeah, 3,000 items that came out, licensed items. Astonishing. Anyway,
But you digress.
Yes. I get off on the Alamo now and again. That it happens. And I'll bring up Wellman at some point during this. These are the things I can't help. And speaking of which, did you come to California to become a cartoonist or to become a filmmaker? Did you still think you wanted to do that?
I had pretty much abandoned any hope of becoming a cartoonist before I came out here. I was working at a film magazine, a trade magazine called Film Bulletin, after I got out of college, and my position was managing editor, which was very boring, writing financial stories and things. But what I really did is I reviewed movies, and I between 68 and 74, I must have reviewed every other picture that ever came out, you know. My reviews were a little bit more esoteric than the usual trade reviews, and because I was very influenced by magazines like Sight and Sound and the Monthly Film Bulletin and Films and Filming and all these British magazines, which were taking genre movies seriously, and American critics, of course, never did. And my mission was to try to find and review every obscure independent movie that was coming out. And since I was in Philadelphia, which was a place where lots of those movies were played, I would hire myself up to some theater in an inner city neighborhood to see the double bill of The Devil's Messenger and Carnival of Souls, which, you know, I wasn't going to play anywhere else.
Sure.
So I did get to, and also I was writing for a magazine called Castle of Frankenstein, which was an FM imitator, famous monster
sure.
imitator.
Know it well.
I would write two different versions of the review, one for them, one for the other guy. And that went through all through the 60s I wrote for Castle of Frankenstein.
So when you were writing reviews, were you seeking out other films? I mean, older films? Or did you do any kind of film research in that respect?
Well, we had at Castle of Frankenstein, we had a Castle of Frankenstein movie guide, a TV movie guide. And this was to counteract the effect of the published movie guides. Before Leonard Maltin, there was a guy named Stephen
Schuer, yeah.
And he had a book of TV movie reviews, and they were very straight-laced and very non-genre oriented and often very wrong. And the entry for Bride of Frankenstein said way above average for this kind of trash. and so we felt that there was a need for people who were a little more sympathetic to these kind of movies to be writing about them. And so a guy named Bob Stewart and I wrote a bunch of stuff for this magazine, which appeared on and off for maybe 8 years. But the magazine itself came out very irregularly. So I was sort of building up a little library of things that I had, you know, written about movies. And in the meantime, I was reviewing contemporary movies for, the Film Bulletin. I had planned to do my own IMDb. I had notebooks full of, I was going to do all of the science fiction and horror movies ever made, and I had a huge notebook with every single picture with all the info that I could get at it, and I subscribed to these foreign publications that different countries used to put out these little promo books every year that summarized all of the different movies that had been made in that country that year and had all the credits and stuff, and many of them were movies that had famous people in them, but they never came to America. And so I dutifully put all those things in there, and I never got anywhere with it, but I still have some of the notebooks with my little childish scrawl, you know, crossing out running times and
Now I can only assume, just based on the movies that you made, that you had a particular fondness for horror and science fiction and genre films.
Those were the ones that I saw and sought out when I was a kid. I mean, I had an affinity for those.
Yeah.
But it didn't rule out other things. I was still am a huge Western fan. And I went to all kinds of movies. I wasn't, the executive suite type of movie didn't really interest me because I didn't really know what that was all about.
Sure.
But now, of course, I like movies in all genres. I mean, I have favorite musicals, I have favorite, war pictures, whatever. But I had an affinity for the horror films because that was what I really gravitated to when I was growing up. And you got to remember, the 1950s was the atomic fear era. You know, we all thought the world was going to end, the bomb was going to drop. We had these drills in school where they made you think that if you put your back against the wall, it'd be okay when the atom bomb went off. And you got this kind of paranoia everywhere you went. And, of course, it was reinforced in the science fiction movies because they were all about atomic metaphors and metaphorical monsters destroying things. And it was a very fearful period. All the way through the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is, in a movie that I did called Matinees, takes place in the Cuban Missile Crisis and uses a lot of the information that I gleaned during that weekend that we all thought there was going to be no Monday, which on the glass is half full in that there's no school, but the glass is half empty in that there's not going to be anything else either.
I can remember that. We had an afternoon kid show that showed Stooges and our gang and that kind of stuff. And it was called Monty's Rascals. And Mr. Monty was the host. And I remember him saying, Now, kids, I know that you're all worried, but the president's going to take care of everything, and don't you worry, it's all going to turn out okay.
They get fired for that.
but I think we were worried. But doing research in those days, in the pre-video days, meant
was no
16 millimeter. I mean, you had to either find it somewhere or buy them.
Some publications. I mean, the state of film scholarship, you know, in that era, was nowhere like it is today. I mean, there would be approved books like Arthur Knight's The Liveliest Art, which, you know, they were fine. They're good books. And there were biographies of Louis B. Mayer and stuff like that. But you didn't really get any kind of analytical writing about any kind of genre films at all. And so the motion picture trades were actually the best place to go to get information, because they had listings and they had the running times, they had the release dates and the title changes, and all those things were actually, you know. But the other place you could go was, there was a book called the BIB book, it was called, Broadcast Information Bureau. And they listed all the TV packages that were for sale to different stations, from the different distributors, and they had lists of movies that you had never heard of, and Atomic War Brides, you know, I mean, movies that sounded great, but, you know, where do they play? How come my station never buys these packages? And so you could cobble together a bunch of stuff like that, but now, I mean, with the internet, I mean, with IMDb, you know, which is mostly correct, it's sometimes not, but, you know, even Wikipedia, which has gotten much better than it was when it started. I mean, there is a wealth of information to be had in ways that were never possible before. And when we were struggling to find, you know, information on some obscure Mexican vampire movie, I mean, there was just no place to go to find that. I mean, you had to go to Mexican newspapers and try to read Mexican. And it was very difficult. And now there's a plethora of information. And I must say, there's a lot of really interesting writing going on the internet. I mean, too much to even catalog, really.
Sure.
I mean, too much to even read. I mean, you find it by links or being connected to something else that you read that has a little dot that says, well, if you like that, read this, which is wonderful. I mean, scholarship is, you know, blooming, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's probably less errors in writing than there were, although I have read a lot of things where people will repeat something that was written by somebody who had their facts wrong, and then they'll get repeated from somebody else, and now all of a sudden you have a factoid that's based on something that's completely made up.
That happens quite a lot, yeah. I notice when I compare what I went through to write my first books, when my first one came out in 83, and what it took to research that, and then what it's taken to research, say, my latest book.
Well, you can research now without leaving your home.
You can't to a certain
degree.
There's still things you can't get, by and large, there's a lot you can get. And now this, I don't know if you've seen this website that David Pierce put up with, that scanned all these trade magazines from the teens and 20s.
I have one for Box Office. Which
is, it's just astonishing. I mean, and it's searchable.
Yeah.
You can search every, actually they've apparently entered every word into the search engine, and so you can search,
and
it's amazing.
That's a lot of work. And how do they monetize that?
I have no idea. That's the good news, bad news about the internet, isn't it? I mean,
you don't have to tell me.
For a reader, it's paradise. But I don't know about you, but I used to write articles and
get paid,
sell them, and now
it's a
different world where nobody gets paid for anything.
That's very true. And when I
he
started,
says doing a podcast.
Well, when I started my website, you know, the idea was to I was a trailer collector. I had a lot of trailers. I used to make trailers. And I thought, well, these things are sitting in a vault. Nobody's going to see them. I should put them up on the internet. And I thought, well, anybody could do that. What can I do to make it different? So I thought, well, I know, I'll do a commentary track for these couple of trailers. I did 5 or 6, and I put them up. And they sat there for a little while. Nobody really much noticed, except my friends noticed. And they said, I have a couple pictures I wouldn't mind talking about. So it started to exponentially grow, and I started adding movies. And originally it was all science fiction horror movies. And then other people came along and said they wanted to do, you know, Spartacus or something. And it was like, okay, do that. And it evolved over the last 6-7 years into Trailers from Hell, which is now a sort of a mini film school. We've got almost 900 trailers up there with like 45, 50 different people talking about them, all sorts of filmmakers. And the only thing we haven't been able to do, of course, is make any money because it's just not set up for that.
Yeah.
But what it does do, and which I am proud of because people have told me that it works, is to steer people toward movies that they just might not know about otherwise. Because the irony in the world we live in, where more things are available to see in different venues than have ever been before, is that you need somebody to tell you that they exist. Because
yeah.
a lot of people just don't know about it. I mean, if they weren't experienced like we were, watching movies on TV at late nights and, you know, just turning on a show in the middle and, oh, what's this? Who's this guy? And, you know, and then finding out what it was. And back then, by the way, they used to identify the movie. You know, if they had the commercial and they'd tell you what you were watching.
Yeah.
Well, they don't do that anymore. So if you don't have a TV that's got an identity thing on it, you're at a hotel, forget it. You're never going to find out what it is. And there's so much hunger for knowledge about movies, and when people find an actor or a director or somebody they think is interesting, and they go, oh, they made other movies. I want to see those movies. Where are they? You know, well, I mean, this is a place where you can learn about that stuff and get directed toward where you can find it.
Yeah. It really is kind of a miracle time now because, again, I remember researching my first book on Wellman. Tracking down the films that he made was a chore, and
involved so many of them were independents.
But it involved going everywhere. I had to go to archives. I had to find private collectors. I had to go to rent them from Films Inc. and Audio Branded and those places. And even then, there were some I just couldn't track down. Now, virtually everything.
Well, particularly the early
is right there at your fingertips.
The early talkies, those are the ones that are the hardest to find because there's a lot of those.
They still are.
A lot of those were never sold to television.
Yeah,
and the Warner Archive, luckily, revolutionized the entire DVD industry, which was, you know, the bromide was, well, there won't be any more DVDs in a little while because, you know, and the studios weren't putting out obscure pictures because they didn't figure there was anybody to buy them. And then when they came up with the concept, no, we won't make a million DVDs and put them in a warehouse and hope to sell them. We'll just get the materials ready and then people can say what they want and then we'll make it for them. And that turned out, obviously, to work for not just Warner's, but all the other companies as well have some subsidiary versions of this thing, none of which are as extensive or as well managed as the Warner one. But nonetheless, through this process, we have gotten hundreds of movies on DVD that I never thought we would ever see in our lifetime.
Yeah,
I mean, I was a big 16mm film collector, and the reason that I was collecting. Some of my friends started me in collecting, and the reason was that if you loved the movie and you wanted to see it and you missed it theatrically, then you had to wait a couple of years for it on TV. And then once it came on TV, you better see it because they're not going to run it again for quite a while. And when they do run it, it'll probably be cut or pan and scanned or you know, screwed up in some way that, you know, you're not going to want to see it anyway. So if you bought your own print, you know, you want to see it in CinemaScope, you buy yourself a CinemaScope lens and you run it in CinemaScope.
Yeah.
And that was fabulous. And that got me through the 70s and the 80s. But then as soon as the video came along, 16 market sort of just dropped away. And although oddly enough, the only way you can really preserve a film is on film. You can't really preserve it in digital. And all these people keep saying, well, you know, we'll just put it up in the cloud and it'll always be there, you know. And it's like, I don't buy it. The cloud isn't going to always be there and it's going to change.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. Everything else besides film has a very limited shelf life, and yet film we've had for 120 years and is still going strong.
Videotape, which degrades, with laser discs, which had laser rot within a couple of years, DVDs, which don't last forever. And I think the on-demand DVDs probably last less well because they're DVD-Rs. And I don't think they're quite as well made as the other DVDs. But, you know, you can't keep – I mean, it was like with 8-track tapes. You just can't keep buying – how many times have you bought The Wizard of Oz, you know? I mean, how many times – how many versions of The Wizard of Oz do you have to buy in your lifetime? Well, they hope you'll buy many, many, many. As many as you have children, you will have different versions of The Wizard of Oz.
I'm building a shelf just for my Wild Bunch Laserdisc, CLV, CAV Laserdisc. just it keeps going on. And now we have the Blu-ray. I have the DVD. It just keeps going. So, and when they come up with something else, I'll get it on that too.
Now they're streaming. And the idea of streaming is that you don't have to own it. You just have it there, and you can access it whenever you want. I find that the quality isn't often quite as good as
the quality is not good, and they're real iffy about aspect ratio.
Yeah.
They'll put a scope film out as 16:9 without blinking an eye.
They routinely do that. You know, even for when you make a film, you go into the transfer room at the end and you make a pan and scan version for 16 for regular like airlines and stuff, and then you make a if it's in scope you make a 1.85 version with the sides cut off because that's the only way HBO will run it.
Yeah.
And so there's all these different hybrid versions, and there's lots of, you know, on the internet there's lots of talk about, well, this movie should be shown in this ratio, and this movie should be shown in that ratio, and just because it was made to be seen in on a widescreen doesn't mean you shouldn't see the tops and the bottoms and the microphone sticking in, and, you know, and there's a whole subset of insanity about that, you know, to the point where On the Waterfront just came out in three different aspect ratios. You know, in 1.33 and 1.85 and 1.66.
But surely it was shot in 1.33, wasn't it?
It was shot in 1.33 to be framed for 1.85.
Yeah.
But it looks better in 1.66 because the framing isn't as tight.
Sure.
So you have your choices, you know. And I think Touch of Evil was another picture that there was a lot of controversies about. What did he really expect? Well, it's a Universal picture. It was 1.85. That's how it was shown everywhere that it was distributed. But it was shot for TV so that they didn't have to do any tricks with it. They just leave the whole frame open. So now it's like because the frame exists, you have to show it that way. And that's just a lot of nonsense.
I thought that aspect ratio was a battle we had won. Once Turner Classic Movies started showing Letterbox films, once all DVDs came out Letterbox,
I thought
we had finally triumphed.
I was on the Directors
Guild. We're going back.
I was on the Directors Guild committee that went to great lengths to try to popularize the idea that you're not losing something by seeing a picture with black bars on it.
Yeah.
You're gaining something. And Turner, who was, you know, did a huge about face from the original plan of, you know, making sure everything became in color. And,
sure.
And then they discovered, well, you know, an old movie is an old movie, whether it's in color or black and white. Yeah. But, you know, that we had seemed to win that argument. But now there's still this room for controversy because people who saw the movies on TV for the first time and saw them with lots of headroom, that's the way they want to remember them because that's how they saw them. And so they, why should I have these 1.85 fascists, that's what they call them,
telling me
that, you know, the microphone should be blanked out. So I saw it had a microphone in the shot. Should have a microphone in the shot now.
It's just it's insanity. I just want to see things properly, and that's
well, we do have the opportunity to do that much more than we ever did.
We sure do, and that's just what I worry about when streaming becomes the only way to see it. When DVDs finally go away for good, then we're only going to be at the mercy of what they stream, and so. But we can't live forever, can we? We'll be dead sooner or later.
No, I don't know how many more DVDs of The Wizard of Oz I'm going to be able to buy in my lifetime.
There'll always be at least one more. So, now, when did you come to California, and did you come aiming to be a filmmaker?
I came in 1974 because a bunch of my friends had come out to work for Roger Corman. And I was a big Roger Corman fan, actually. I had seen all those Poe movies and all the other pictures when I was younger. And that seemed to be the way that people were breaking in the 70s to the movies because it was a very tight stricture out here about unions and, you know, who you can work for and who you can't work for. But one thing you could do is you could work non-union, and you weren't paid very much, but you were at least making films. So I came out here to edit movie trailers for Corman, and I did a couple, and my friend Alan Arkush joined me, and we became the trailer department for New World Pictures, which was at the time thriving because the 70s was an incredible period for independent movies. The rating system had basically come in and allowed people to show things that you couldn't see anywhere else, and so lots of nudity, lots of violence, lots of outre subject matter that, frankly, 10 years later wasn't being made at all. And so we, you know, we got very conversant with what was being made and how it was being made, because you have to make a trailer, you have to learn the movie, you have to identify and dissect every scene and try to find a way to make it shorter to make your point. And then you start realizing, well, you know, you could make this shorter if you didn't need that line there, and you don't have to have this angle. And then you start to realize, well, if you didn't have this angle, you wouldn't have to relight, because you wouldn't have to turn the camera around. So you sort of pick up all this sort of filmmaking know-how when you're doing trailers. It's kind of haiku. To the point where we said, well, gee, we could make a movie like this. We could make a picture as good as Women in Cages. Along with John Davison, who was the first person in my group to come out here, we talked Roger into letting us actually make a movie for $60,000 in 10 days, based on the three-girl formula that they were currently using. It was nurses and teachers at the time. We said, what if it's actresses? And we make a movie called The Starlets, and it's about girls having sexy adventures on a movie set. And so we made our picture for no money, and realized that because we didn't have any money, there was really no way we were going to make a releasable film unless we made it around stunts and action scenes from movies that we were familiar with from doing the trailers. But they were a polyglot group of pictures. There were movies that were set in outer space. There were movies set in the future. There were movies set in jungles. There was period movies and Bonnie and Clyde ripoffs. And so we said, well, it's about a movie company called Miracle Pictures. If it's a good picture, it's a miracle. And they are making movies, and we can use the crew as the cast, and we can have our actresses dress up like the people in the clips that we're going to use, and we'll make it like these are the different movies that these people are making. And so we made this picture, which eventually reached the world under the title Hollywood Boulevard, and is a bona fide cult movie.
Sure.
Because it's a fairly accurate picture of what it was actually like making movies at that time in the 1970s. And it didn't exactly set the world on fire, so we went back to doing trailers. But it did ultimately lead to a career in directing. And it was something that, you know, I had come out here to be an editor. I didn't know whether I would be a good director. But I did discover when I... Because editing is a very sort of... I wouldn't say antisocial, but it's a very insular kind of thing. You don't do a lot of gregarious hand-holding and stuff.
Sure.
So it was like, well, I wonder what it'll be like. I wonder if I'll enjoy that. And it turned out that I did enjoy the atmosphere on the set and the fact that people could contribute and you could change things. And so it was, yeah, this is fun. This is something I think I could do. And so it eventually led to my second picture and my third picture, and I became, quote, a movie director, which was never really the plan. It was just sort of a vague thought that maybe that might be one of several things that I could do in the movie business.
Now, it seems to me, I mean, just looking at it from the outside, that almost more than anybody I can think of, you seem to have gotten to things that were right for you and in your interest and in
my wheelhouse.
Got almost right away and stayed there. I mean, almost always were able to work on things that seemed to fit you very well.
I was very lucky to be able to make movies in a genre that I understood. And I have used one rule as I'm plotted through this career, which is to never make anything I wouldn't go see. And so the kind of pictures that I was doing, luckily for me, suddenly jumped from B status to A status. So I was able to make what were essentially glorified B pictures for Roger Corman. You know, I made the Hollywood Boulevard and Piranha, and I worked on Rock and Roll High School. And then I made a werewolf picture called The Howling, which was a sort of a B-plus picture. And then I started working with Spielberg, making Gremlins, which was now a B picture that was an A picture. And that kind of film, which used to be considered basically trash, was now a mainstream subject. And, you know, I remember remarking when they made the Lone Ranger feature, that usually this kind of material was only handled in serials, and that's where we got Star Wars, that's where we got Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's where we got, you know, this big jump that took place in that generation of people who were trying to recapture the things that they loved when they were kids by making new ones in the same vein. And so all through the 80s, I mean, basically what you saw was people trying to emulate the kind of movies that they loved when they were kids, which meant a little less content. I mean, there was a little less intellectual content. These were not exactly, you know, adapted
sure.
stage plays. They were action pictures, and they were kind of juvenile. And so that became the new paradigm for that period. And it's still with us. I mean, the movies now, feature films, are almost entirely aimed at people under 25.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the content, you go to cable television, you go to, you know, anybody, overseas films or indies. But the Hollywood formula is pretty much based on spectacle.
Yeah. Kind of things blowing up, or
well, they don't just blow up. I mean, they blow up. There's two movies about the White House blowing up.
Yeah.
They're out within a couple of weeks of each other.
And one know. About the Alamo blowing up. I always loved The Howling, and I loved it for several reasons. One of which was I was very good friends in the last two or three years of his life with Charlie Barton, the director. And one of the characters in The Howling was, which I had to think was,
oh, of course,
purposeful.
There are a number of characters that the picture was written by John Sayles, and his thing was he liked to name characters after baseball players.
Mm.
My thing was I wanted to name characters after werewolf movie directors, and so we actually made arrangements with just about everybody to use the real names. I mean, I remember talking to Terrence Fisher. I think he died a couple of weeks after I talked to him on the phone, saying, can I use your name? But I want to put it on a girl. I want to be Terry Fisher.
Yeah.
And he thought that was fine, you know. That was sort of a fan thing. It was sort of a nod to the fans.
Sure.
And the movie has a lot of that kind of thing. And hopefully the trick is that you can do that kind of thing if it doesn't annoy anyone else, but it's not apparent to somebody else. There's one thing in The Howling that is an egregious mistake in that way, which is that there's a scene where Roger Corman looks for change in a phone booth, and it's a sort of a ripoff of the scene in Rosemary's Baby where William Castle is standing outside the phone, and Mia Farrow thinks it's a Ralph Bellamy. And then it turns out, no, it's just lovable William Castle. And this is the same kind of a gag, and it's a little meta. But but the problem was that if you didn't know who it was, there was no reason to hang on that shot. That's the kind of gag that you can do in the background while something else is happening.
Yeah.
But you can't just have that be the shot. And I remember thinking, that's a mistake. And you learn from it. I've done many similar things in movies since then, but I've never put them in front.
But everybody who knew it loved that gag.
Yes, it's a good gag. And Roger was great to do it. Yeah. But still, it's something that you don't want to do.
Yeah, I can see your point. But still, I like the gag. So, but what interests me about the Howling and what you're talking about, genre films, Piranha, which I also thought was very funny and very good, and that came off to me like kind of a drive-in movie, and yet The Howling seemed like an A picture. I mean,
it's a little more complex.
It seemed a bit more emotionally
Piranha's
true, and
a repeat of the same situation throughout the movie.
I mean,
the piranhas, that was always the problem. How do you get the people in the water after they know there's piranhas in there? And the first writer, whose script we didn't use, invented a bear to chase people into the water. And then when they knew there was a bear around, he had to invent a forest fire to chase the bear to chase the people. And so John came in and rewrote it and made it a pseudo-political and, I think, a much better movie. And then again, I had the same issue with The Howling. The script really wasn't quite up to snuff, and I had been intending to do a picture called Jaws 3 People Zero, which fell apart. And when it fell apart, there was an opening on The Howling because the director had left, and so I moved into that, but then the script obviously needed work, so I brought in two guys. One, a guy named Terry Winkless, who did a really good job based on the book, but then we realized we couldn't stay that close to the book, so we brought John in, and he came up with the whole Est idea, and the idea of the people, the werewolves in the colony, and all that kind of stuff,
and it just
came together. But it's a better screenplay. And also, it's not his first screenplay, because Piranha, I believe, was his first screenplay.
Hmm. And just to bring things full circle, he later wrote the first draft of the Alamo script for
That's right.
John Hancock. Yeah. Halley has a great cast, and Dee Wallace, that's how Spielberg
yes,
discovered Dee Wallace, right?
He saw her in that picture, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of
trivia.
Movie history right there. That's, without her was...
I'm sure he'd seen her.
What would E.T. have been?
I'm sure he'd seen her in 10. Though. She was really good in 10. That's where I first saw her.
Yeah. What I asked you a little bit earlier, or what I said a little bit earlier about your seeming to find a happy place in having your own interests be reflected in the jobs that you did, in terms of business, was that how did you get that kind of freedom even after you started working in bigger pictures? Where obviously the studio is going to be
I was very lucky because when I was working for Corman, he was a very non-interventionist producer, provided he got what he needed to sell the movie, and the movie wasn't, you know, badly made. So you really did have a lot of freedom, and I found that I could do jokes and I could put gags and references and things, and it was all fine with him as long as it wasn't, you know, as I said, up front. When I did The Howling, APCO Embassy was a very loosely run studio by a guy named Bob Ramey who used to work for Roger. And they were having a sort of a horror movie renaissance. And they were doing pictures like Scanners and Escape from New York and all that. And they had a niche for the audience. And although there was some confusion about the first day's dailies of The Howling, where they were confused as to whether I was making a comedy or a horror film, a situation I have since encountered.
Often, I bet.
Yeah. They were very receptive, too, and that picture was very successful for them. So by the time I ended up at the studios, I came in on a very unusual course because I had been asked to do Gremlins by Steven Spielberg off a writing sample that Chris Columbus had written that Steven wanted to make as a low-budget horror film. His first picture for Amblin Productions was going to be shot in Oregon or something, and it was going to be non-union, and it was going to be kind of cheap. And as we worked on it, we realized that wasn't going to be possible with the kind of creatures that we had to create. But again, you know, this was for Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers on their own would never have made that picture, certainly not that way. And during this period, I was also working on the Twilight Zone movie, which was being made while we were starting to work on Gremlins. During the period of working on Gremlins, I was also working on the Twilight Zone movie, which was an odd situation because this was a Spielberg production, but there had been an accident, and there was some question as to whether the movie was going to go forward. And, when it did, it went forward rather unsupervised because nobody at the studio seemed to really want to take responsibility for it. So for me and George Miller, who was doing another episode, we were like, wow, this is great. We're working at this big studio, and there's all these technicians and all these great sets and everything, and nobody says anything. They just leave you alone, do whatever you want. But in fact, we discovered on our next pictures that that's not the way it worked, but I was always sheltered by the fact that Spielberg was the executive producer, so they would defer to him. So when I don't believe that without Steven Spielberg's name on the movie, that Gremlins would have been as off the wall a movie as it was, because the Warner Brothers didn't really understand it, and they were confused by it, and it really took him reassuring them to be able to let them get it through the way it was. Now, the success of that movie obviously earned me enough cred to be able to make the next picture and have people say, oh, well, let's sort of let him do what he wants because, you know, he just made a big hit. The sad fact, however, was that the next picture was Explorers, which was a movie that got caught in between two administrations at a studio and was released unfinished. So, and also on the day of the Live Aid concert where nobody went to the movies, and it came at the tail end of a whole series of teenage scientist movies. And
I saw it.
Well, it was a disaster. And so that tends to work against you. Let's put it that way. And so the next time my next outing was again for Spielberg, and it was Interspace. It was another kind of offbeat movie, although to me, I was thinking, well, now finally I'm making a regular movie. It's not, this isn't as weird as the other movies that I've done. And then, of course, it ended up being almost just as weird. but again, it was, there was a distance between me and the studio. I really didn't have that kind of problem that people, as people have now, particularly. But even then, I'm sure they were having it. But I was a little insulated because of the Spielberg connection.
I love Gremlins, always did, and I had when American Movie Classics still showed movies and still showed classics, I wrote and directed a special for them called The Great Christmas Movies, we did a little segment on Christmas horror films, and the way we cut it, we had all, you know, Silent Night, Bloody Night, and all these, you know, Black Christmas and all these things. And I had the little monologue from Phoebe Cates telling about why she hates Christmas, which I've always thought was one of the great weird scenes in a movie.
It's so weird they wanted to cut it out.
And it did get cut out from the Great Christmas movies because we took them this cut and they said, that whole horror segment's got to go. It's got to go out.
Oh, the whole segment?
Yeah, the whole segment went. And I said, come on. Because we did interview Bob Clark and you know, Olivia Hussey and all these. So we had great. I mean, I thought it was a terrific little segment. They hated it.
Whatever happened to it?
And that segment just went away.
No, it can't be a DVD supplement or something?
No. That, unfortunately, they only licensed the clips for 5 years.
Oh, I see.
And that was, what, 15 years ago? Yeah. So it's low res, you know, it's dead. It's a dead duck.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But, I love that scene, and I love the movie, but I love Gremlins 2 much, much more. And it's always, you know, I had this conversation just a couple of weeks ago with somebody who said the old, I don't know why they keep making sequels to movies. No sequel has ever been as good as the original movie. And I said, oh yeah. Tarzan and His Mate is better than Tarzan. Bride of Frankenstein is better than Frankenstein. After the Thin Man, I think, is better than Thin Man. And Gremlins 2, I think, is better than Gremlins. And maybe better is not right, but...
Well, it's certainly different.
It's so funny. And it's just... It really does seem to keep getting back to what I keep hammering on, and I don't mean to. But it really does seem to be you just... In your element.
Well, you do try to inject as much of your personality into a movie as they let you.
Yeah.
And this was a case where, because the first picture had been so successful, and they really didn't understand why, they tried themselves for years to come up with a reason to make a sequel other than the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tried all these different scripts, Gremlins Go to Mars, Gremlins Go to Las Vegas, Gremlins whatever, and they spent money, you know, and they just couldn't come up with anything that they wanted to make. And so they came back to Mike Fennell, the producer, and me, and said, look, we realize that you guys must have had something to do with the success of the first picture. So we want this picture for next summer, and if you will do it for us, we'll let you do anything you want. And that's not an offer that you hear very often. And frankly, the experience of making Gremlins was a very difficult one because there wasn't a lot of studio support, and it was a very complicated thing to make at the time, and it was exhausting. And I thought, okay, let's think about this. And so we got together with this writer friend of ours, Charlie Haas, and we came up with a kind of a movie that spoofs the idea of sequels and spoofs the first movie and the rules and all of the stuff that you had to buy in order to be able to enjoy it. And plus, it was the beginning of the 90s. It was 1989. The 90s were upon us. It was the future. We made one of the characters a sort of a combination of Donald Trump and Ted Turner,
mm-hmm.
To the point of doing colorization jokes, which unfortunately we got beat out by a picture called The Big Picture, which did the same joke that we were going to do.
Oh.
We had to cut ours out. But one thing that was great about having that character is that Ted Turner actually has an end of the world tape, or had an end of the world tape. That was notorious among the people at the TBS, and we got somebody who had seen it gave us the lowdown of what it was, and we made a replica of it for John Glover to run when he thinks the world is going to end. And I mean, it was that kind of thing. I mean, it was filled with whatever was in the zeitgeist at the time, and they let us spend a lot of money, three times as much as we spent on the first picture. And it was, it turned out to be, you know, they still didn't quite understand it, but it was a very funny picture that people laughed at when they went to see it. But unfortunately, it fell victim to a scheduling change. It was supposed to open in on Memorial Day, and the picture was ready, and the TV spots were on and everything, and then they suddenly decided they wanted to move the date to July 4th opposite Dick Tracy, which was going to be very big, and they were afraid maybe even bigger than their record holder, Batman. And so they figured, well, if we open Gremlins 2 against it, it won't open as big as Batman. So that's where we went. And unfortunately, a lot of people who had seen the TV spots thought the picture had already opened. And then when they reappeared, it was like, is this a reissue or what? And we just sort of, the momentum just got kind of lost. Mm. And a picture that costs three times the original needs to be three times the original's success. Mm. And this wasn't. So, unfortunately, it didn't really find its audience until, VHS.
Yeah. Well, it's a shame because it's terrific. And, for both people listening to this podcast, I say, both of you go out and watch this thing because it's, I think it's really funny. And Chuck Jones is in it.
Yes.
And Leonard Maltin gets killed by gremlins, which is always worth saying.
Well, Leonard didn't like the first movie. and so I said, when I went to his house, he had gremlins cereal. What do you have cereal for? He didn't like the movie. He said, well, the cereal isn't very good either. But I said, well, you know, why don't you come on? And you can say whatever you want about the first movie, and we'll kill you. And he said, sure, why not?
Now, you became friends with Chuck Jones, speaking of him,
well,
right?
Well, I met Chuck at Telluride.
Me too.
I think everybody met Chuck at Telluride. And he was a wonderful guy. I mean, he's, in my lifetime, the guy most like Mark Twain that I've ever known. And he's in Gremlins, playing himself basically.
Yeah.
And I put him in Inner Space, and he was in a supermarket line in a scene, and spent the whole day drawing pictures for the crew and the extras and stuff. I mean, he was just that kind of guy. He was a great guy, and we got him to do the credits for Gremlins 2.
I always looked forward to Telluride because he would give he would show cartoons in that big like high school auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And answer questions, and I did it one year, and then I just started doing it every year. I would just wait outside because he would always just walk out by himself, and then I would walk back into town with him and just talk about Carl Stalling and stuff like that.
Very affable.
And he was great. Yeah. He was just so wonderful to talk to. I treasure those times. That's three or four years in a row that I just had little Chuck time every year. It was great. I do want to put in a good word for Erie, Indiana.
Erie, Indiana was a show.
Because that was a really fun show.
Erie, Indiana was a show that I got in on the ground floor of. I was asked to do the pilot. And if you want to do a TV show, that's where you want to be. You want to be at the pilot stage. Because I got them. I talked them out of their bad idea for the lead kid. I sort of managed to push it in a direction that I thought would be more commercial. And the two guys, who Jose Rivera and Carl Schaefer, very bright guys. And I think it would have been. I think it was a wonderful show. It would have been more wonderful if they'd put it on not opposite 60 Minutes. I did three or four of them, and I was in one of them playing myself at the end. But the thing about the show is that it's practically vanished. It is available on. There's a boxed DVD set, which I guess you could probably find on Amazon, but it's not exactly in the public discourse anymore. And yet, a friend of mine has a 10-year-old, and I just introduced him to it, and he watches it over and over and over. Because what happened was that even though not enough people watched it when it was on NBC, a couple of years later, that Fox started to run it on Saturday mornings, and kids got into it, and they went, oh, shit, there's only 18 of these. Got to have more. So and it was too late because the kids were now older. You couldn't go back and reassemble. So they said, well, what we'll do is we'll rejigger the footage from the show and we'll do a new episode where the old kids go through a time warp and become different kids.
Ah.
Right? And we'll build the same set in Canada where it's cheaper and we'll just make more episodes. The parents will be different. Everybody are different because it's a different dimension.
Sure.
And they made, I don't know how many more of these generally low, crappy episodes, and so they could have more episodes of it. But nonetheless, I don't see it anywhere. I mean, it's not on any schedule that I see.
Well, that worked for Doctor Who. So it's,
well, Doctor Who is never
it possibly could have just to turn him into a different guy periodically. You know, that seems to work. Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you something that I probably should have asked you early on, but I think it's a good way to wrap up too. Who are the filmmakers that really meant a lot to you? I mean, obviously Corman, but
well, it depends.
I see a Cocteau poster here.
Yeah, I mean, it's people say, "Well, so what's your favorite movie?" Or you know, it's like, "Well, what time is it?"
I'm leaving it broader than that.
I mean, I love the old masters. You know, I mean, Hitchcock and Kurosawa and Howard Hawks and Orson Welles, and you know, I mean, you name it, all those people. I love people like John Farrell, the Big Clock. I love people like Earl C. Kenton, who was a guy who worked a lot with Carl Struss, who was a great cameraman. He did a lot of horror films like The Island of Lost Souls, and James Whale.
Sure.
I think is great. And there are many more people that I like than I don't like. I mean, there are so many filmmakers whose movies are, I think, only now being appreciated. I mean, if you go to Dave Kerr's column, at DaveKerr.com. Mm-hmm. He's the New York Times DVD writer at the moment, and he's got this series of threads from all these different people, and they're currently talking about Lou Landers, who was a B-picture director at Columbia, and there's a current, they're arguing about the William A. Cedar and Mark Sandrich, and who directed Stair Rogers pictures, and mm-hmm. which one of them was really more talented. And it's like, it's just amazing. So many years after reading Andrew Saras's book, you know, American Cinema, which was really the only place you could go for years to find out any information on people this obscure. And even then, some of the movies he probably didn't see, and some of them he may have or whatever, but it was all based on probably memories and recollections of seeing things. And there were all this information about all these people and these different, put it in different categories, the Far Side of Paradise and the Pantheon and all that, you know, and some of which were just wrong, you know. I mean, you just got it wrong.
Oh yeah.
But he was one of the great writers on the
show. Oh, sure he was.
He came to our college once. He was really a very interesting guy. But you know, people are picking up on that stuff now. I mean, the kind of thing that you could just see a reference to otherwise is now actually you can read in some depth by people who have spent a lot of time thinking about it. And that's something that was hard to do before. It was hard to find people who were being considered. And I guess as a filmmaker, it's nice to know that after you're gone, people are still going to be arguing about you. You know, I guess that's a sort of immortality.
It sure is, you know? Yeah. You know, you're the first person I think I've ever met who spontaneously mentioned John Farrow, who I consider to be, and this, some people may argue with me, but I'll stick with it, the most interesting person who ever worked in Hollywood ever.
Well, he is a pretty interesting person.
He was a really,
I mean,
man.
If you did a book about him with the depth of the ones about John Ford, I mean, you'd find some really, really interesting stuff.
Unfortunately, most of the people who worked with him are dead, who could really tell you the real stories.
No, I know.
But I got some good ones.
I've got some from Geraldine Page told me, I met, because I interviewed her for Gremlins.
Yeah.
And she told me stories about Hondo, and not particularly flattering stories. But my experience with him, obviously, was, you know, seeing pictures like The Big Clock, which is a great movie.
Oh, yeah.
And The Alias Nick Beale, which is an unknown great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And even movies like Saigon and pictures where the camera movements and the way he blocks the scenes are so fluid. And it took me I don't know how many screenings of The Big Clock. I ran it in 35 millimeter in Wisconsin for some people and introduced it. And I'm sitting there and I'm realizing, oh my God, I never noticed that none of the sets have doors. The camera, when the camera moves and people go into other rooms, they just go past the wall and the doors never open. And it's like, why haven't I seen this movie 20 times? I never noticed this.
Yeah, more camera movement than any other American director. I think he's like Max Ophuls in that. I mean,
it's really great. And
as a technician, superb.
Oh yeah.
And as a human, probably
perhaps
less
superb,
so.
But then again, John Ford was no, you know.
Oh God.
kind of a bully.
I think a lot of those guys had their dark sides. Henry Hathaway,
like Curtiz, you know, was a terrific director.
Yeah, I think Charlie Barton is the only one who was just a complete teddy bear. So.
Well, look and, who he was working with.
You know, he worked with Moochie. Come on. How, yeah. Well, Joe, thank you so much. I really appreciate your taking the time to do this. This has been so much fun for me.
Me too.
I sure hope you enjoyed my talk with Joe Dante. I sure did. Would love to do it again sometime. I don't know if that's ever going to be possible, but a guy can dream, can't he? A man's reach must exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for? So maybe someday we will talk again. And in the meantime, I will put plenty of Amazon links to his works on his page on the podcast website, which is, say it with me, thecommentarytrack.com. That is thecommentarytrack.com. You go there, you hit the Amazon links, you buy his movies. He's going to get a little bit of a residual of some kind. Amazon's going to get some money. The original studios are going to get some money. I'm going to get a little kickback. Everybody is happy. What kind of deal is it where everybody is happy and satisfied? Yet that's what this is. So click on those Amazon links, and I will bless you in my prayers tonight. I will say thank you for all my faithful listeners who ordered stuff on Amazon, and I'll mean it because I'm grateful. If you want to help keep the commentary track going, maybe you might consider making a little donation. You just go to thecommentarytrack.com, and you'll see a little link there that says donate. It'll take you to PayPal, and you can leave me a dollar or $2 or $5 or $10,000. I highly encourage you to do the latter, but whatever you can afford will help. This is pretty much a money-losing proposition, and I'm not complaining about that. I knew the job was dangerous when I took it, but it's still, a little help would not be amiss, and I'd be grateful for it. Please do that if you can, but if you can't, you might consider buying some of my books. I got plenty of links to my own books, and you can, if there's a price on the link, you can order directly from me, and I'll autograph it to you if you like. And if there's no price on it, then there's just an Amazon link. Just go to Amazon and order it there. But I've got nearly all of my books represented on the page. There's a page just called Books. I also have a link to Joe Dante's Trailers from Hell website, which I highly recommend. As a matter of fact, that link has been on my links page since the very beginning of this podcast, months ago. So this is not even occasioned by my meeting Joe Dante, but proof that it's a website that I've always loved and I check in on regularly and always have a great time when I'm there. So consider doing that. And if you don't feel like you have any money to part with, and I understand that, times are really, really hard. This is like Wild Boys of the Road hard around here. If you can't donate or give me any other kind of book sales or anything, then I'll give you a free way you can support the podcast, which is go to iTunes, give me a good review, a 5-star rating, say nice things to me on the review, and that'll be very nice. 31 nice people have done that so far, and I would like to have that be about 10 times that by the end of the week, and I know that's an impossible dream, but I'm dreaming the impossible dream. I won't even go into that song, but I was about to. You can bet your boots I was about to, but I'm not. That's how much I think of you, the listener. How much I respect you and your wishes that I will not sing that song. So do that. And in the meantime, thanks to my wonderful, beautiful, golden-toned wife, Claire McCullough Thompson, for being my announcer. Thanks to James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com, and my personal website, frankthompson.tv, both of which are certainly worth a visit from you. I want to thank, of course, as always, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand, who wrote my beautiful theme music that I enjoy so much every week. I want to thank you just for listening and for spreading the word. I hope that you will like my Facebook page. I hope that you will follow me on Twitter, which is @FrankThompson10. I guess there are 9 other Frank Thompsons on Twitter. Who'd have thunk it? It's such an unusual name. I'm surprised. But follow me there. Go to Facebook, friend me as a real friend on my own personal Facebook page. I'd be delighted to be your friend. And I'd even be delighted to be your neighbor, like Mr. Rogers. So do that and just spread the word. I need more people to be listening to this. And I want more people to be listening to this. And I think we've got great shows. This now makes 34 episodes in the can. And I have some great ones coming up. And it's I think we still have many, many, many fun hours to spend together. And I hope that you'll help as many people as possible come on board. So, thanks again to Joe Dante. It's been a real pleasure talking with him. And it was a pleasure talking with you, my faithful listeners. So, I'll see you next time. And don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.